see if you can let your body just completely, deeply relax. Relax so much that it's blending in with its surroundings. Letting the muscles release themselves from the bones. And just take your consciousness through the different parts of the body, and if there's any place that seems tense, just focus on that area with some love, suggesting that it simply relax. And as you are aware of the sensation, the pleasurable sensation of relaxing, suggest your body to relax even more. Simple act of being aware of your body or a given part of your body, just that alone relaxes the body. And do the same thing for your mind without trying to control the mind. Just let the mind be as it is, with yourself as the compassionate witness. Providing an atmosphere for the mind so that it can just simply be. Let the one who's aware of the mind be relaxed. So even if the mind has tension or sorrow, let it be in the company of or witnessed by a part of you that is relaxed, that can accommodate all of the parts of the mind. And in that attitude, let the mind relax out into space, unconstrained, unhindered, free and without judgment, simply allowed to be. Let the body and the mind simply relax into space. And now, without trying to control your mind, other than being relaxed, being the relaxed presence that's aware of it. Let your own being come into the forefront. Just simply you, the conscious being that you are. And let your presence fill the mind and the body and your perceptions. And let the mind and the body and all of the perceptions relax into your presence. It's like asking the wave to let the water fill it and to let it relax into the water. That already is the reality. In fact, the water is the wave. The wave is the water. In the sense that the wave has only water for its being. And still we ask the wave to relax. So that it can stop scurrying around looking for the water. Now we ask the mind to relax, the body to relax, so that the changeless self that I am easily comes to the forefront of the mind. I could ask the wave to just relax. Relax into the water. And then I could ask the wave, what are you like? What is water like? So I can ask you, what are you like? What is yourself like, this conscious being that you are? Your presence, this me, the self that you are. Why is the self called Ananda? The simple, unassuming being that you are. Sat. Because you are, you exist. Chit. Because you are consciousness. Ananda. Because there is nothing more dear than your own being. The wave cannot not be water. Even in a violent storm, when the wave spin, pushed from one side to the other, foaming and drops flying all over. The wave is still only and solely water. The totality of my experience is wholly and solely consciousness or me. I get confused by the interacting complexity of names and forms and colors and sounds and feelings. get so involved in the events, the perceptions, that I miss the one being that is actually there. Like in a bas relief sculpture, with so many characters and so much activity, you can get lost in the fascination around the activity, not recognizing the stone or the clay that is all that is there. Let your body and mind relax, completely surrender to the self that is its very being. Om Parakaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Ritavarashinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Manusandadami Bhagavad-gītē bhavad-dveshini.
Verse 46.
Yāvanārtha uddhapāne, yāvanārtha uddhapāne, sarvatasam putodake, sarvatasam putodake, Tavan, tavan sarveshu vedeshu, tavan sarveshu vedeshu, brahmanasya vijanataha, brahmanasya vijanataha. Yavan artaha udhapane sarvataha samputa udike tavan sarveshu vedeshu brahmanasya vijanataha. This is it. It's a nice verse. Yavan artaha. As much use. There is as much use. Yavan artaha. Oh, Cindy. Oh, I did that. Okay. Yavan artaha. There's as much use. Udhapane. In a well. Sarvataha sampluta udike. When the water has flooded everywhere. Udaka is water. Sampluta means flooded. The water is flooded. Sarvataha, in all directions. Flooded. The water is just flooded everywhere. How much use is there in a well? Right? When the water is flooded over the well and it's formed a lake. In other words, you've got this well sitting in the middle of a lake. Okay? So what's the use of the well when it's sitting in the middle of a lake because of a flood? Okay? So much use, tavan. So much use is there. Sarveshu Vedeshu. In all of the Vedas. Locative plural, right? Sarva, all, Veda. Sarveshu Vedeshu. Tavan. So much use is there in all of the Vedas. Brahmanasya Vijanataha. For the Brahmana. Brahmanasya, genitive singular. For the Brahmana, Vijanataha, present participle. For the Brahmana, and genitive again. For the Brahmana, who knows? Vijnanam means, the jnanam is vijnanam. It means vishesha jnanam, where you know yourself. You know Brahman. Aham Brahmasmi. You know yourself as Brahman. You have direct, aparoksha jnanam. You have direct, immediate knowledge. So you know yourself as Brahman. So for the person who knows, I am Brahman, Brahmanasya vijanataha, what use is all the use all of these Vedas are really like a well, the use of a well that's been flooded by water, you know? So really, it's
heavy duty.
It's a beautiful, beautiful verse, right? The source of Ananda, the only source of Ananda, of fullness, is the Atma, is the Self. That's where we get our experiences for the mind. Like for the mind, you will have experiences of fullness, happiness, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. Because these experiences of happiness come and go and come and go and come and go, we look for a cause for the experience of happiness outside of ourself. Right? And so, because of that, we're always bound by this samsara. If I could only have this, that might make me happy. If I could have this, that might make me happy. And so, in fact, the whole first part of the Vedas, right, is all about this. Accepting that ignorance. Accepting that self-ignorance, where I really don't know what the psychodynamics are of Ananda. What really is the source of Ananda? Where is the Ananda? Who is the Ananda? What is the Ananda? Yeah. Not understanding that, I'm seeking Ananda in the world. This is everybody's predicament, not just one or two people. It's a massive delusion. Okay. And because it's a massive delusion, it's a group delusion, it's a universal delusion, you know, it seems normal, right? Mm-hmm. This is sanity. Whereas in fact, it's not sanity. You know, it's insanity in the sense that we are running around searching, you know, for the self. You're searching for Ananda where it isn't, continually over and over and over and over again in every conceivable way, and continually being disappointed, 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 disappointed after moments of joy that fade away into just sterile objects. Moments of joy in a situation that you're left with a situation without the joy. So this is samsara. This is exactly what it is. Right? And that samsara is simply brought about by the mind's looking in the opposite direction. Looking for the Atma in the opposite direction. I mean, imagine it. Here I am. And I don't know that I'm looking for myself, but here I am. And I'm the one that illumines the mind, and the mind illumines the sense organs, and the sense organs illumine the objects. My being is the source of the Ananda, the experience of Ananda in the mind. And I'll get into the dynamics in a minute. My being, the Atma, is the source for the experience of joy or wholeness, fullness, happiness, all the gradient in the mind. I'm the source of it. And I light up the mind, which lights up the sense organs, which lights up the objects. I think, my mind thinks, that the source of the Ananda is in the object, which is in what direction? The opposite direction. And so I am running, in a sense, in reality, there is no direction. But from the standpoint of myself as a jiva within duality, I am looking here. I am looking out here toward the object, which is really illumined, being illumined by Ananda. So my mind is being illumined by Ananda, which is illumining the sense organs, which are illumining the objects, and I'm running after the object. All my mind has to do is relax into the Ananda that's illumining it. But it doesn't do that because it has no way to know that. And it does because the mind is so intelligent and logical, it knows how to infer and deduce, make deductions from its experience. For instance, if, and this is everybody's experience, and so we can all learn this ignorance one from another, is that if I fulfill a desire, I do become happy. I do. And even though it only lasts for a moment, I still do become happy. And so does everybody else. Right? And so it's a universal. If you fulfill a desire, you will become happy. Isn't it true? It is true. But the problem is, and this is where the mumukshu is created, is that it is true that when I fulfill a desire, I do become happy. And so does everybody else. But it's also true that that happiness is like a little flicker that lasts for only a moment in time. And I, in fact, am not seeking that little flicker. I'm not seeking a flicker of happiness. I am seeking a stable well-being into which I can relax. That's why one way that they define moksha, or liberation, for a person who's liberated, it's called the alam buddhi. Means that the mind says enough. Alam means enough. It's often used for food. You know, when they're serving food and pouring it on top of your hands because you're trying to say, I don't need any more, I'm full, I'm full. That's the alam buddhi. I don't need any more. It's full, I'm fine. And so say always in your heart you have that alam buddhi. It's like, would you like to have a new car? Would you like to have some more money? Would you like to have a better job? No, I'm fine. Oh, would you like this? No, I'm fine, really. Yeah. No, really, couldn't you just give me this? No, I'm really fine. I'm fine. Do you need anything? No, I really don't. Do you want me to go away and stop asking you?
No, I'm fine.
I like it here. I'm fine. Yeah. That's the alam buddhi. How can you have that alam buddhi? Is because that the source that the mind is enjoying is oneself. And that self is not going to be changed by whatever the world is doing. But it's just not. Because the Atma, your being, is not an object in the world to be acted upon. Right? I can't do anything to myself. I can't shift it. I can't cover it. I can't make it any different. And my mind can't get rid of me. Even my mind, the mind cannot move away from me. Just like in the meditation I was talking about the wave. If the wave gets really upset and agitated, say, it's just because of the wind. The wave is just moving all over the place. And the water is breaking up, you know, in the wave, and it's all, you know, becoming shattered. What is there in this, you know, hyperactive wave? What is there? It's only water. It takes a certain, you have to get it. You have to recognize that. But when you recognize it, what you're recognizing is that what is here is only water. It's only your being. And that recognition requires, first of all, being able to relax into yourself so that your mind can get to know, it's like the way of getting to know the water, right? Your mind has to relax a little bit so that it can get to know the very being that fills it. The being that you are, the conscious being that you are, is self-evident. You don't need knowledge. You don't need a mind to light you up. You don't need knowledge to light you up. You don't need anything to light you up. Consciousness is consciousness. So it is, you are your own experience. Nothing is giving that to you. Nothing is denying it from you. You could be totally, totally ignorant. Maybe you don't even know how to read. Maybe you don't have ears to hear. Maybe your sense organs are mangled and not working. In terms of your self-experience, it is exactly the same. Whether it's you or Ishvara or the worm, it makes no difference. Because Ishvara, the whole creation, is not giving the self. It's its self-experience. Ishvara also, if we look at the whole Maya Upadhi, the Maya Upadhi itself cannot touch the self. Whether it's a small inferior upadhi, like a little worm that doesn't have a mind to speak of. That mind also, that worm also, that upadhi, has nothing, no impact on the nature of the self. Whether you're an exalted human with massive intelligence and medha shakti, all kinds of memory and all of these things that we would love to have, that also has no effect whatsoever on the self, on your being. So the self that you are is indestructible, it can't be touched, and it is the very water of the wave. But now when you think, I like the wave example, because if you think about it, for the wave, what is the truth of the wave is only water. There's no distance between wave and water. Right? The wave can't go anywhere to find the water or experience the water. But because of ignorance, because the wave has ignorance, right, it is looking for the water. And since it's looking for the water, all that those sense organs, little wave eyes, okay, so little wave eyes, all of the wave eyes are capable of seeing are little wave forms. That's all they can see. And so they look and look and look. But there's epistemological limits, you know what I mean by that? The eyes only have a certain sphere that they operate in, and that is the sphere of forms. Your ears only have a sphere that they operate in. That's the sphere of sound. That's all they can see. And so here the little wave is looking, 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 looking for the water, but all it can possibly see are form and color. It can't see the substance, which has got to be free from form and color, right? And so it can't see it, it can only be it. And so a guru wave has to come along to this little wave and make its mind slow down, because the mind's hyperactive, looking, looking, looking for this, so I can, looking to find myself. It has to make that mind, that little wave mind, relax. And then recognize different, recognize in the form of differentiation really. Recognizing what is its being. The being that it is not away from it, but the being that you are also is not modifying with the forms. You're the conscious being that you are. That is the very being, the substance, the consciousness, the me, your sense of me. That is the very substance of all that you experience, actually. It's the substance of the entirety of your experience. This me is not changing. But the mind has no being apart from it. And so the thoughts go on changing and changing and changing, having for its being something that doesn't change at all. And that's, in a sense, the Achilles heel, is to recognize, who am I? The mind says, like the water says correctly, the wave says correctly, I am water. Isn't it correct? if the wave, the totally ignorant wave, it doesn't know anything. It's a samsari wave. And that wave says, I am water. It is absolutely correct. Right? Because the self-experience of that wave is water, nothing else. Now when I say, I am a conscious being, I am absolutely correct. I am referring to myself, the one self that is there. That's the part that's not known. But when I say, I am a conscious being, just talking from the standpoint of this body, it's like the wave saying, I am water. There's no mistake at all. The mistake comes when we misidentify this being, not that it's I am the conscious being and the conscious being is me. See what I mean? Like this. If the wave says, I am the water, that's correct. I am water. But then it says, and the water is me, the form. And that means when the form dies, the water will die. Right? So now I say, I am the conscious being. That's correct. And so your sense of me, the sense of me that is there, which is the beloved, which is the most dear for you, that's the one thing that me that you identify as yourself, that is correct. The problem is that then this me is now taken to be this form, which is finite and different from you. Do you see the problem? If you, on the one hand, you're correct. The wave says, I am the water. But then going from the water to the wave, there's a problem because then water becomes limited to that wave. The you, when you say, you're ahankara, the I notion, you says, I am a conscious being. I'm a conscious being. The one you're talking about is Brahman. It's not part of Brahman. It's not like Brahman. It is Brahman. The problem is that because there's self-ignorance there, you take your being to be one with these objects of experience that come and go. And so now we have to recognize that, oh, wait, this me doesn't come and go. It never changes at all. In fact, all of these experiences that are coming and going, they're not away from me. They're not away from me. When they're there, there's no distance between my being and the being of these objects or these experiences. But they're coming and going and I'm not. Consciousness is not coming and going. It's the constant. My mind simply needs to differentiate itself from the changeless being that I am. And when it can do that, once it gets it, then that mind has a home. Itself is its home. Like what about when the wave says, I am water, and then recognizes that the water is something which doesn't come and go. Its form can change and change and change. The water stays the same. See that? The only difference in Drishtanta's illustrations have their limitation because they take place in time and space, and water in some senses changes, but the waterness of the water does not change. Right? Consciousness doesn't come and go. It's not objectifiable. Your being is not objectifiable to be a thing in the creation. Your being is the very self of the whole creation, in fact. That's why when we use the dream example or the example of an imagination, why that example is so important for you to play with is because you can recognize that your being is the stable self of that whole imagination. Like my famous meadow, if you imagine the meadow and people walking in the meadow, your being is not the being of one character. Your being is the being. Your being is the self of the whole. In fact, you are the whole. And so the thing is, it is very easy for you to say, see that in that illustration. The relationship that you have, right, to your thought, to a thought. You can say, yeah, the thought, the imagination, it really is only me. I am its changeless self. It has no being apart from me. If I imagine a meadow, that whole thought is only me. It comes from me. I am itself. My being is the being of the whole thing. The me, this me that I am, is the me of the whole thing. Any part of it that says me, 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 is only me. Right? That's the me that it's enjoying. That's I am its truth. I'm Ishwara. I am the Ishwara of the thought. I am the Ishwara, the Lord of the imagination. Because right? I am the self, and I have the Maya. The Maya under my control, is how they talk, right? And the self with the Maya under my control. That Maya, that creation comes, is sustained, and it resolves in me. There's nothing there but me. It's easy for you to see that in terms of dream or in terms of imagination, to experience it, to recognize the reality of it. Why is it hard here? Why is this different? Why is it different? One thing is this dehatma buddhi, this identification with the body, is so strong. But really, really, this body, mind, sense organs for all of us, for each one of us, everything that you take to be and make you an individual is actually an objectifiable experience. There's a subject-object there. You know? Your conscious being is not changing as these experiences are coming and going and illumined. So these experiences belong to Ishwara. If all of the experiences, if all of the upadis, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the moods, the emotions, the eye thought, all of the upadis really are part and parcel of Ishwara, of the whole, then my being is not the being of just this upadi, it is the being of the whole. Consciousness is the being of the whole. Because if yourself is not contained in anything, because it's not objectifiable, it's not like a little pea in a pod, right? It's not contained, then just like your relationship is to a thought, how is that relationship different of the self to the whole? From the standpoint of the jiva, take a look at it as your being to a thought, to an imagination. And now put that jiva with its imagination into Ishwara as part of this big, infinite imagination. And what's the difference? And so now, experientially, right here and now, what is the difference? What is the difference? How is it that you think that if you can recognize the wholeness of yourself in reference to a thought, what is the difference now in reference to your being and the creation? Is there anything in your experience that's away from your being? You can say, well, I don't have sarvajñatvam. I'm not omniscient. In other words, the whole infinite creation is not known to me. That's because I don't have Ishwara's upadhi. Right? This is a jiva upadhi. This jiva upadhi can only see through the sense organs and limited mind. But this sense organs and limited mind are part of the Ishwara upadhi. And this Ishwara upadhi is right here, that I'm experiencing right now. This is it. This is Ishwara. Right? Well, who else is it? Right? So this body, mind, sense organs belong to this Ishwara upadhi, and I'm experiencing right now the Ishwara upadhi, of which the conscious being that I am is a part. So think of it now. Say you go into the dream, and there's a dream character in the dream. You're a dream character in the dream. And you're looking around in the dream through your sense organs. So now, everything that you perceive in that dream enjoys consciousness. Right? There's nothing in your experience that's away from consciousness. Where does the consciousness come from? Where does the consciousness come from that is filling, that is allowing your mind to have that experience? And is your experience, any of your experience, as you're walking around as a dream jiva, you're walking around as a dream jiva, but is any experience within that dream that you're experiencing as a dream jiva away from consciousness. You could say, well, it's not away from consciousness, but it is my mind, my limited mind, experiencing Ishvara, right? So there's a limited mind experiencing Ishvara from within Ishvara, from within the creation. And so isn't that kind of once removed? Consciousness of consciousness, or the mind's perception of the creation. The mind itself is having a conscious perception of the creation. Do you see that? Like right now, here I am in this room, my mind is having a perception of the room. Right? And so actually the consciousness that I'm experiencing is of this perception. You see that? The perception is filling my thought. It's not filling the actual room. Am I losing everybody?
Yes, say it one more time.
I'm slowly getting us back to the verse, don't worry.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't hurt to hear it more than once.
This is the thing. I'm going to go a little bit different route and then come back. When you say I am, now let's go back to the wave. When you say I am, the wave says I am water, you are actually referring to the one you need to know. When you're seeking for liberation to know Brahman, you want to know that Brahman. So now the wave wants to know Brahman. Who is Brahman for the wave? Is the water. Right? The wave wants to know Brahman. It's seeking to know Brahman. We think we need to gain an experience of Brahman. The wave thinks it needs to gain an experience of the water. It can't gain any more experience of the water than is already there. It's not possible because there's nothing there really but water. And so what the heck is the problem then? You know? The problem is that because the mind and the sense organs are only capable of seeing forms, they can't see the water. They can only see the forms of the water. That's our problem. We can only see the forms of consciousness. We can't see consciousness because we are consciousness. And there is no distance between the consciousness that we are and the forms that we perceive. Right? So now what we have to do is say, all right, the teacher has to say, okay, everybody, this is what we're going to do. Okay. All forms, everything that is perceived, let us recognize that fact, that the eyes and the sense organs, they can only perceive forms. They can't perceive their self. They can perceive the forms that are that have for their essence the self, but all they're allowed to see are the forms, not the essence of the forms. They are the essence of the forms. They can't see the essence of the forms. So you are the essence of the forms, but all you can see are forms. So now you have to be able to differentiate what you are from what you see. See what I mean? So whatever you can see doesn't count for the moment. Because whatever you can see or objectify that has a form or that is subject to change or modification or differentiation, that we're discounting for now. Because that's a form, and we want to only see what the essence of the form is, and we can't see that through our sense organs. If we can't see it through our sense organs, or through our mind for that matter, how can we know it at all? The reason that we can know it is because we are it. You are it, and it is self-evident. You don't have to bring in something to light you up. Your being is consciousness. So the self-experience of me is already completely 100% here, without any distance between you and it. And so now what is the problem? Well, the problem is that the mind keeps wanting to have an experience, because our whole life, beginningless lifetimes, that's what we know. That's how we gain knowledge, is through having experiences of more forms, right? More forms, more things, more relationships. And now we have to say, wait, let's pull back all those forms for the moment. Let's relax all those forms so that we can recognize who is the one there filling the forms. And who is that one going to be? It has to be me. Because there can't be, if you are not a form and your being is not objectifiable within time and space, right? There's not going to be room for anything else. In other words, we can differentiate one form from another, which we can, if you look around, we can differentiate all of ourselves, one from another. But the self that is not a form, how is that going to be differentiated? How are you going to differentiate consciousness, one from another? Me, one from another. There's no way to differentiate it. And there's no way to objectify it and to look at it. It's just who you are. And then can that be known? Well, it can be known because you know yourself all the time. You say, right now, you say, I am a conscious being. Who are you referring to? You're referring to Brahman. You're referring to yourself that never changes, never modifies in any way. That one that you're referring to is exactly the one that we have to recognize as being Brahman. We think we have to have an experience of Brahman. No, we have to recognize that the self that we are is Brahman. It's quite a bit different. You know? Difference between thinking we have to have an experience of Brahman to recognizing that this experience, who we are, is Brahman. Right? There's a very major shift, even in understanding the language there. So now say when the mind recognizes, I am Brahman, recognizes that this me, I am Brahman, but the Brahman that I am illumines me, the mind. The Brahman that I am, the conscious being, that is the truth of the mind, illumines the conscious mind, the mind. That's why the mind is known. The body is known. The sense organs are known. The world is known. It's known through the light of my being, which is self-evident, self-effulgent. So this changeless being that I am, what is its nature? Ananda. What do we mean by Ananda? It's what the mystics call the beloved. That being that you are, there's nothing more that you would rather have you... You wouldn't give up your being for something else. Let me have some. You give me some popcorn and I'll give you my being.
Great.
So what the mind is also searching for Ananda in the form of the bliss or joy or ecstatic experiences that the mind is capable of having when the mind becomes quiet. Right? So the mind thinks that's the Ananda or that's the wholeness. That isn't the wholeness. There are a whole variety of beautiful experiences that the mind can have when the mind becomes calm. Because that mind stuff, the sattva, it reflects the self in a variety of different ways depending upon the subtlety of its own condition. And those are all beautiful experiences. But their mental experience, their mental modifications, their vrittis. It's called the Anandamaya Kosha, right? They're vrittis of mind that are very, very pleasurable. But those pleasurable vrittis mislead me. They again take me in that direction, the direction of the vritti, rather than the recognition of the self, the changeless self that is present to the vritti. That Ananda is much greater. It's much more subtle. It is different. It is a different meaning of Ananda. It's the meaning of wholeness, of limitlessness, of the quiet, abiding wholeness of the self that can only be defined by your being, not by an experience in the mind. We use the ananda, the sukha experiences, the experiences of joy in the mind, to point to the ananda of the self. Because it's when the mind is totally relaxed and therefore ananda is manifesting in the mind. It's manifesting in the mind. It's different than just the nature of your being, but it's manifesting in the mind. The mind is very happy. All is well with me. All is good. And so since you are pleased in that condition, we can use that. We use that to make you understand the relationship of the ananda to the relaxed mind. And to make you see that that mind is enjoying the self, nothing else. But the source of the ananda is only the self. But that being, that ananda that you are, that's illumining that mind, that is its own ananda, its own being, which is unsurpassable. And so now here in this, unsurpassable not as a limitless, blissful experience of the mind, unsurpassable in its own terms, for what it is, for what who you are, that can't be differentiated or can't be labeled in terms of a sukha vritti. It's not just a sukha, a joyful thought modification. It is only what it is. Okay, so now, for the jnani, for the wise person who knows this self, all of this sukha, let me have this so that I can be happy. Let me go to Swarga Loka so that I can be happy. Let me have this experience so that I can be happy. This is nothing. For these little experiences, these little wells, they're little wells of sukha. What are those? These little wells of happiness. What do those mean for a jnani whose mind has the very source, the ocean of ananda? The atma is the ocean of ananda. These wells, you know, the only source of the ananda the only real source of the ananda is the atma. And so for the jnani, for the one who knows, this brahmanasya, Brahmana here means the one who has sattvic. The one who has viveka, who has a sattvic mind. Right? For that mind, for the one, and one who knows the self, all of these Vedas are just, they're like a well, the usefulness of a well for an area that's been flooded, you know, by water. A well sitting in the... Swamiji used to tell the story of, and this is true in India, they will actually make their wells in riverbeds. They'll dig wells in riverbeds. And then in the rainy season, of course, they don't bother with the well because the river is full, right? So they're not going to trek out into the middle of the river to find the well, right? They just get it from the river. But then, of course, in the dry season, then that's an area where there's going to be the most water. That's why they do that. So this is probably, it's a beautiful verse, you know, that they have a direct experience. So here, what would be the use of the Vedas which tell you in the most dharmic way how to gain happiness from this world? If you do this in this way, you will become happy. If you do this ritual in this way, you'll get this result, which you want because you think it will make you happy. All of these things that give these little moments of sukha, what use would those be for the person who has recognized the source? Why would that person go out to the well when their mind is already flooded with the source? See the thing? So it's a really wonderful verse like that. So now the thing is for each one of us, really, to spend time recognizing the truth of that. Because your mind, for every human being, your mind has a long history, a beginningless history, right, of looking out here for the forms to make me happy, rather than the mind simply being with the self, relaxing into the self. Right? And so there's a lot of unwinding that's got to take place. There's a lot of, you know, the mind going out there, getting in trouble, getting bashed around a little bit, pulling it back, you know, and pulling it back and pulling it back and learning how to be with the mind, to be kind to the mind, to raise the mind like a child in the light of what you know, right? To give the mind a time to grow up. And I mean grow up in a positive way, like you would bring up your child. You give your child an opportunity to grow up, and you protect your child, and you give it what it needs, the guidance. The buddhi gives the guidance and the care and the knowledge and the satsang, you know, the satsang, the support to grow in the light of knowledge. Because your knowledge, when you gain knowledge, you now are seeing the world in the opposite way as how you've seen it before. Right? Now the whole universe is in you. Right? Yourself is stable and the whole universe is in you. And before, you were a finite creature walking around in a universe different from you. It's quite a different vision. And so when you see it, when the shravana is taking place and that unfoldment is taking place, you can see it. It can be so clear. But then to walk out of the room and think that all is the mind, you know, after lifetimes and lifetimes of being totally oriented toward externalizing the self, projecting the self on the world and then running after it, you know, you have to give it some time, the opportunity to own itself back up. And it does that. But it just requires some love. Mm. The love that you would give a child, you give that love to your mind. You give it the space to work these things out, to understand, to re-experience life in the light of your knowledge. That's what happens. You gain knowledge. This happens even as a samsari. As a samsari, just without any self-knowledge, you gain knowledge, and then you now continue. You experience your life in the light of your new knowledge. That's how we grow. Then you gain more knowledge. Then you experience life in the light of your knowledge. And then your mind and your emotional system and everything changes. You know, it adapts to what you now know. But the one that you were before your new knowledge comes and confronts your new knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. So you know something, now you know something, but the one who didn't know it now rises in the light of what you know. And now, this one that knows now also has to have some psychology. You have to know a lot. You have to know to be kind. You have to know to be patient. You have to know to take care of that child inside who is growing up. The child who's growing up in the light of your knowledge. You know, and to help it along. Rather than to be critical. The critical one also needs to be objectified. That's part of the child, right? So that's not also, you can't also say you start beating on the critical one. Mm-hmm. Then again, you're the critical one. If you're beating on the critical one, you become the critical one. If you're beating on the judgmental one, you're the judgmental one. But the judgmental one is beating on the judgmental one. The critical one is beating on the critical one. You're right. So sometimes that's why it's, I think one of the blessings of having a teacher, or being able to spend time with your teacher and spend time with, like for me, it's a blessing that the time that I was able to spend with Swamiji, because that kind one is externalized. You know what I mean? So when the kind one is externalized, you experience over and over and over again in so many different ways, you know, kindness or interest, you know, non-judgmentalness, wanting to help, being interested. I always experienced that with Swamiji, somebody who There wasn't a judgmental bone in his body. He was, whatever problems I would bring, which were many, he was interested and wanted to help and wanted to figure it out. And he would think about it and, oh, you know, what to do about that or whatever. Whatever he did, it really didn't matter to me what he did. What mattered was the environment in which he did it, the way in which he did it, which allowed me to be that way. You know, you learn to be that way toward yourself if you have somebody who's that way toward you. You know, if there's somebody that cares about you and is interested in you and doesn't have that judgmental thing going on, and you're exposed to that, then you learn to give that. You know that such a thing exists, and you give that to yourself. You kind of rubs off by osmosis. You know, and that type of a strong presence, right? That type of a strong presence will counteract the negative presence we might have in ourselves, the bad parents or the judgmental so-and-sos we've picked up along the way, judgmental parents, judgmental siblings, judgmental people in our lives, critical people, people who don't love us. You had to grow up with people who don't love you. There's nothing more excruciating than that, to grow up in the presence of people who don't love you, you know, or who are disturbed themselves or whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very traumatic. And so what's going to neutralize that? How to find in yourself, you know, that loving presence. So if you have a teacher, or, you know, it's even said, even if there is one person in your life, say you have the worst family, worst parents in the world, if there is one person in your life, say when you were growing up, that gave you some love, mm-hmm. we're so, you know, we can get by with so little. You know, we can survive. Just one little person did some few acts of kindness to give me some strength, you know, and then we can make do with that. Because the truth of it is that the Ananda, you are the Ananda. It doesn't matter. These things, horrible things happen. You know who wants that? Nobody. But those horrible things don't happen to the self. The self is not being touched by it. And so the self is always the truth of the mind. Just like the water is always the truth of the wave. It is always there. It's always changelessly there. And so we can always tap into it. The mind finds a way. Right? The upset mind that's going around looking for this or that can find some way to have a moment of peace, a glimpse of wholeness. Yeah. Anyway. Getting off track. Mm-hmm. Let's stop for a minute. Purnamidam.
Purnamidam. Purnat Purnamudachyate. Purnasya Purnamadaya. Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Is this verse real famous?
Mm-hmm. It is. And it's the verse that leads into Karma Yoga. Because he's now built up making Karma Yoga something that we want to learn. But now, this verse, you need this verse to really understand Karma Yoga. Because Karma Yoga is that really the attitude that allows the mind just to simply relax in the self, which is the very source of all ananda anyway. And so if you don't really understand that, then Karma Yoga also doesn't make as much sense. One has to know that the source of the ananda that you seek, of the wholeness that you seek, the well-being that you seek, is your being. And now, if that's so, it's not going to be a question of having it this way or that way or this way in terms of objects, but it's a question of the attitude with which you approach the world. So that attitude doesn't disturb, you know, your well-being until your knowledge is firm. Because Karma Yoga is a way to be with the world as a doer in the world. You know, that doership is still there. How to be in the world in a way that allows my mind to relax in myself. And then for this knowledge to bless me.
Do you remember what you were, remember at one point tonight, I don't know if you remember, you said, did I lose you? And I was kind of curious where you were going with that. Do you remember? I think you said
I remember that. Saying it.
Well, prior to that, I think...
Oh, I do remember.
You do?
Mm-hmm. Do you want me to pull that back together?
I
think what I was kind of noticing some blank looks. And I was realizing I was getting into some complexities that were... okay. What it was is... If I have an imagination, okay, it's easy for me, I was talking about how easy it is really for me to see that I'm the very self of the imagination. Okay, and, okay, it's also, I would think, easy for me to see, now if you're a character, you have a character in that imagination, and that character is perceiving, right, the world through his or her sense organs. And the thought modification that they're having is now also the same. That thought modification, that imagination within the imagination now. Do you see that? You've got, because the character in the dream or the character in the imagination is now having an imagination. Okay. Now, that imagination that the character is having in the imagination is once removed. It's an imagination within imagination. And so how can you know that the imagination that the character is having is enjoying and how that obviously enjoys consciousness, right? How do you know that that is the same as this? Because here I am, here I am as a character in an imagination.
Here I am, this Jiva.
I am a character in Ishvara, right? I am a part to the whole, the Jiva within Ishvara. And now this Jiva within Ishvara is having a thought modification, which is once removed, right? It's a thought modification within Ishvara. This thought modification that I'm having is a thought modification because of my sense organs and mind within Ishvara. And so I'm asking you to make this jump telling you that the thought modification that you're having, just as your self is the truth of that thought modification, like that, this whole creation, right, has for itself yourself. The self that illumines your thought modification is the self that illumines the total thought modification. And so I was saying, it's once, total thought modification means Ishwara. So I was saying that's once removed. And so you might feel, well, how can that be, how do we know that that is the same? You know, that there's a parallel there. Like, another way of saying it, how would we know that if we say, when I'm dreaming, if I go to sleep at night and I'm dreaming, for me, that is the only reality. And then I wake up back into this. Right? Who's to say one is more real than the other? You can say one, really, because experientially, we're only validating the experience from within the experience. Like I'm saying, you know, this is real. How can you say this is real? Well, the dream character said, this is real. How can you say this isn't real? Look it. If I pinch myself, it hurts. Don't tell me I'm an illusion. We don't use the word illusion, really. But don't tell me I'm mitya. I pinch myself. I see you, you see me. But this is, so this validation is taking place within the box of the dream. So, but then if we say, yeah, but the dream is taking place within this reality. And the Swamiji will say, yeah, this is a bigger joke. Mm-hmm. It lasts longer. This is a bigger mitya, right? And it lasts longer. But nevertheless, it's still a fact that the dream world is validating itself only from within itself, not from outside of itself. From outside of itself, we say, it's only a dream. That has no essential being apart from myself. That's the reality we give it from outside, in that, you know, kind of that point, being able to look at it from outside. We can't have that point to be able to look at the creation from outside. Oh, this is only, you know, this is only Bhagavan's Maya.
So we have to take the Upanishads for being
the Upanishads are the pramana for that, but the pramana takes you step by step to the recognition of the reality of that, because it can't be any other way. Mm-hmm. See, when you understand Maya, for instance, when we analyze the nature of perception, the nature of duality, the nature of the names and forms that we see, that all of this matter that we deal with, you can't find any substance here. Even in terms of time, infinitely divisible by time, in terms of quality, infinitely divisible, in terms of objectification, in terms of breaking it into smaller and smaller parts, there's no possibility of you ever discovering anything that is here. You're seeing these names and forms, but give me something. Give me an object. You know, and I'll prove to you it's not an object. It's a conglomerate of two or more objects. So give me the object, and then I'll split that one. Give me the object, I'll split that one. To give me something, for you to give me something, we have to take the form off it.
Ananda.
Yes, Ananda, limitless. Ananda is really Ananta, the endless, without end. Anta, end. Ananta, without end. The limitlessness of the self is experienced in the mind as Ananda. It's the bliss experience in the mind has for its self the ananta, the limitlessness of your being. The limitlessness of your being is, it remains as it is in the bliss experience in the mind, and remains as it is in the negative, sad experience in the mind.
Yeah, that's the trick.
Yeah. This is the hardest thing for people to understand, and it's what keeps a person away from this knowledge, because we're looking for an experience. Experiences come and go. You have to recognize the experience that doesn't come and go. Right? The you that is there in every single experience. Now, when the mind recognizes that, it does relax. And so the mind does enjoy bliss and happiness and much more peace, much more of the time. It has a happier baseline.
Want to stay there.
Well, it has a happier baseline of experience because the problem is solved. And so it's relaxed. And so the mind does become more peaceful. But that isn't the moksha. You know, the moksha is the mind's recognition of the self that is not going to become upset no matter what it does. So that the mind is actually freed of itself. The mind doesn't have to be afraid of itself anymore.
What those koshas, like you mentioned, and all the Maya kosh. What?
All
how
the koshas,
does that fit?
All the kosha means covering, and the covering is sheath. The covering is the covering of ajnanam, and so for all of these five koshas, the anamaya kosha is the sheath, the covering made of food, anam's food. It's not that this body is like, you know, covering it like a sheath is covering a knife or a blade of grass. It's that this body covers the self by ignorance. Because I can say, I am this body, and in that way it becomes a covering. The pranamaya kosha also becomes a covering. I am the vital force, I'm, you know, how I'm feeling, I am alive, you know, the life force. That's a covering. My essence, I am the life essence, you know, the energy. The manomaya kosha, the mind, the buddhi, the jnanamaya kosha, these are all points of identification, and that's what makes the covering. It's not that these things are actually covering me and the self is inside. It's a covering of ignorance.
Different kinds of...
Points of identification.
Points of identification, yeah.
Same as upadhi.
What seems tricky about this whole thing of being a moksha is that in a way you get into it because you want to escape from sorrow. You want to be happy. But if you're looking for an experience of happiness, then you're not going to actually have self-knowledge. Because this self-knowledge is not, as you say, an experience. And the ananda you're talking about is not the ananda of, I guess, it's more subtle than the ananda of...
let me say it like this. We've all had experiences of happiness and well-being. Where you feel all is well with me. And we would like that to stay. We'd like to know where it is, who it is, where it comes from, and how to keep it. So Swamiji used to use this example. You know, everybody's been in India, you know, Madras coffee is so famous. Everybody knows what that perfect cup of coffee is. You know,
so good.
It's just so perfect. You know what it is, that you have that ideal in your mind, that ideal cup of coffee. And so you're always trying to replicate it. So also everybody has had this times in their life where you have experience where this is me. This is who I am. This is how I'm supposed to be. Right? But then it goes. So where does that come from? Who is that? Right? So now, what makes that as though come and go? Right? So what happens is that the mind, you know, is projecting out and then getting in all kinds of trouble, all kinds of tension, you know, which is covering, you know, it's competing with my own well-being, actually. And so what happens is with self-knowledge, that mind relaxes. That's one thing. But it relaxes in the recognition of that stable me. And it relaxes into that stable me, in a sense. And so then the mind isn't lost anymore. You know? And so it's not at all a question of not seeking for happiness. We're all seeking for happiness. But the thing is that happiness, what we're seeking for is found. Right? And then we can enjoy happy vrittis and joyous vrittis and blissful vrittis and all of that, but you're also not dependent on that either, because the nature of your being is whole. And that being right now, at this moment, is whole, is experientially whole. It has to be recognized. And it's competing with pain and agitation and wanting the world to be this way or that way, wanting the situation to be this. So the mind is very engaged in trying to manipulate the world into something I can tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you know. And so it's the mind has to, as the mind starts to understand where the source of the ananda is, it starts to become less engaged in having to manipulate the world. You may still be manipulating to try to make things better, but you're not at stake. So there's a level of relaxation. And so the mind starts giving up that type of thing. And in that giving up, you find your own stability. Does that help? Kind of?
Yeah. No, I think the thing is that really struck me was that this, as I understood that you're pointing to, is again that it's not looking for an experience of bliss, although that can... seems like it's closer, you know, an experience of relaxation, happiness, and everything is okay, and all that is closer than when one is normally running around agitated and everything. But that's not actually, though, the self itself.
Yeah, then
the self is more subtle than that.
What you can say, though, sometimes if you say, I'm just looking for the words that get our little flags for me. So if you say, like, the self is more subtle than that, I don't want you to mean that, okay, you have this happy experience, but the self isn't present to that. It's more subtle or it's away. It's not that it's away. One thing you can do is when you have a happy experience, the mind can say, you know, who am I, the one who's having this happy experience? And then resolve into that. Who is this one that is so enjoying this happy experience? And see if you can pinpoint that a little bit. And then as you keep doing that, you'll recognize, gee, this one that is there having the happy experience, I'm always there. There's never a time that I'm not there. And then you recognize that then you ask, well, why is that one called Ananda? The one who's there present to the happy experience is the one that is called Satchit Ananda, that's called Swarup Ananda, the Ananda of one's own nature. And then what you realize is that one that is there having the happy experience, you differentiate it. And then you get to know it. Then you recognize, I'm always there. I'm never not there. And that is the Swarup Ananda. So it's just different. It's the difference between the bliss in the mind that comes and goes and the ananda of the self that is always present. You have to play with it.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you get what I'm saying, kind of?
I do, yeah. I guess there's some confusion as to why is it called ananda. That's a great question. I mean,
because that's what you have to ask yourself.
Exactly.
You have to ask yourself that question because... there is no ananda like that in the world or in terms of avrittis that come and go. There's nothing like you in the world because you are the self of the world. You're not an object in the world. You're not a name and form. You're the essence. So there's nothing like you. You're only like yourself. You know, and so if we say the self is love, so I can say that. I can say ananda is love. But then your idea of love is relational love that comes and goes as a thought modification in the mind that has love, loving more and more and the most love, you know, degrees of love, depths of love. Those are all vrittis. So if I say the self is love, then the way the word love is being used has got to land on your being. And when it does, then you could say, oh, that's true, the self is love. Right? Just like you'll say, oh yeah, the self is ananda. There's no greater ananda than that. But I never thought of me as ananda. I never thought that my being is this being that I am is love, but now that you mention it, it is. Yeah. And it's so strong. Yourself is so strong. Strong, not like muscle, but strong, like unflappable, stable. Sometimes one word they use is kutasta. It means an anvil. Self is like an anvil, you know, where everything gets pounded on it. And so I think that's in it. It's an ancient example. But when you think of your being, you're immovable. Nothing will move you or rock you or push you. It's so solid, but not solid like concrete. It's just the... Then how can you possibly know what that means? The only way you know what that means is when you're kind of recognizing yourself and saying, yeah, I see what she means. Well, yeah, I guess nice. That's why they call it an anvil. <That's laughs> <right.
laughs> Yeah. We have that expression, bottom line.
The bottom line. Yeah. Are you done?